First, let me take a couple of minutes to say some personal remarks. Usually when I get in the pulpit, I'll get in preaching, but I think it's appropriate for me to say a few words first to thank you for the invitation to be here. It's the first time I've been to Douglas Hills. Many of you have seen me, and I've met you in other places, but it's the first time I've been here. The first time I go to a place, I like to sort of give an overview of where I've been, and often some of you will know people in those places and that I know, and that'll make it easier for us to know one another. I started preaching in Richmond, Virginia in 1958. After 5 years there, I'd preached the summer of 57 and then went back in the summer of 58 to preach full-time and stayed a total of 5 years and left and moved to a place called Louisville, Kentucky. I don't know why I left after 5 years. Franklin Tuckett moved every 5 years, so I thought Frank Jamerson was supposed to move every 5 years. There was no reason to, except I just thought you were supposed to move. And so we moved to Wendell Avenue. Moved there with one boy. While we were there, we had two more boys. And stayed at Wendell Avenue for about a little over four and a half years. Stan and Peggy were there. Did I baptize you, Stan? Yeah, I didn't. Okay, I couldn't remember whether I baptized Stan there or not. But anyway, they were members there at the time. And then we moved to Georgia, moved to Cordial, Georgia, stayed 5 years in Cordial, then went to Columbus, Georgia, and worked with the Rose Hill congregation there for 6.5 years. Then moved to Dothan, Alabama, stayed there 10 years. And then in August of 89, we moved to Lakeland, Florida, and now we are starting in our 12th year. With the Southwest Congregation in Lakeland. So those are the places I've worked, and you probably know some people in some of those places, and we may have a whole lot in common. It's good to be with Paul Earnhardt again. We have worked together a couple of times. Most of the time, I have been in his position for the week listening to him, and I much prefer that, that he's the one that's the victim this week, that he has to sit and listen to me. So I'm looking forward to the week, and I hope we have a good week together. We're starting this morning with a lesson on heartfelt religion. It's one of my favorite lessons, and the reason I'm starting with it is that I want to emphasize that if our religion is not heartfelt, it's not acceptable to God. The only kind of religion God accepts is heartfelt. He does not accept ritualistic religion or formalistic religion. We can go through the right acts, but if we not go through them with our heart in it, it's vain in the sight of God, just as much so as if we went through something that's not even in the Word of God. We must not only do the things that God has said, we must do them for the right reason. In other words, our heart must be in it. And the Bible certainly teaches that we should have heartfelt religion. But there's a difference between heartfelt religion and emotionalism. And we need to understand the difference between the two. Heartfelt religion is the feeling that we have in our hearts that is produced by the evidence of truth. Emotionalism is the evidence. And the reason we believe that we're doing right is because we feel right. And the Bible clearly teaches that emotion can be produced by truth or by a lie. An example that comes to mind, and I'm sure you would think of it, is Jacob in the Old Testament in Genesis chapter 37. When his sons brought the coat of Joseph, their brother, to their dad, they were jealous of him, and when he went to check on them, then they took his coat and killed a goat and dipped it in the blood and brought the coat and presented it to their father. And their father was grief-stricken. The evidence convinced him that his son was dead. Jacob had the same emotional experience that he would have had his son actually been dead. But his son was not dead. And yet, about 22 years later, there was some other evidence presented to him in the 45th chapter of Genesis, after his sons had had to go down to Egypt and buy grain. And then Joseph was there, of course, and you remember that story. And finally, Joseph sends for his father to come down, and the whole family, to come down to Egypt. Beginning in verse 26 of the 45th chapter of Genesis, Genesis chapter 45, beginning in verse 26. And they told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart stood still because he did not believe them. It's interesting, isn't it? He heard a lie and believed it readily. He heard the truth and couldn't believe it. It was just too good to be believed, I guess. But you think about people today. There are people today who will readily believe a lie, and you tell them the truth, and they can hardly believe it, hardly accept it. But Jacob had to believe it because it goes on and says, and they told him, saying, in verse 27, and when they told him all the words which Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. Then Israel, or Jacob, said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. And so here Jacob is finally convinced that his son Joseph is alive. And so the truth now causes great rejoicing. The error, the lie that he believed, had caused great grief. But it was the same kind of an emotion that he would have had what he believed been true. Emotionalism is that which guides us simply because we have a feeling. We should not be surprised, really, that people today are following their emotions. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7 that there would be people in the judgment who would say to him, I felt like I was doing right. I was satisfied with my religion. Remember he said when they stand before him, he will say, depart from me. But they say, Lord, we did many wonderful works in your name. We prophesied in your name. We did all these good things in your name. What's wrong with us? We were sincere. But they were not approved of God. They followed their emotion. They felt like they were doing all right. The wise writer of the Proverbs said in Proverbs 28 and verse 26, he that trusteth in his own heart is a fool. Now that's not what I think about it. That's what God said about it. He said, a man who trusts in his own heart is a fool. I understand that to mean that if I have no better evidence for what I'm doing than the way I feel, I'm a fool. Not everybody in the world who feels right is right, certainly. But there are many people who have, as the only basis of what they're doing being acceptable to God, that they feel all right. They're satisfied with their religion. When I was in Columbus, Georgia, I met a man who called himself the original Georgia prophet. He was one of these, quote, Reverend Ike disciples that believed that if you want your pie in the sky and by and by, then don't come to him. But if you want it now on a silver platter, then come to him. And he believed in being wealthy here and that God was going to make every person wealthy. All God's children are supposed to be wealthy. And, of course, he was telling people that they needed to send their money to him. That tells you who's getting wealthy, doesn't it? It's the one giving it, not the one getting it. That's getting wealthy. But anyway, he was teaching that doctrine, and I was doing a devotional on the TV station at the time. And he had boasted that he would answer anybody who would ask him a question. And he'd get some high school kids in there to ask him questions, and boy, he'd just answer them just like that. Well, one of the employees at the TV station asked me if I'd come and ask him some questions. I said, sure I will, but he won't do that. Oh, yes, he said he would. And so I went and met the fellow and talked with him. He told me that he had been saved 2 years before he ever read or heard anything out of the Bible. And he really felt he had been saved for 2 years before he ever saw a Bible or heard anything in the Bible. You know, that makes as much sense. I was raised on a farm in North Florida. It makes about as much sense as if I told somebody, you know, I went out and gathered a corn crop 2 months before we put the seed in the ground. You know, it's silly. But you know, a person that's guided by emotionalism, that's not silly. Makes good sense to them. Because objective revelation makes no difference. And it's hard for us to understand how people who are guided by emotion cannot be approached with reason, because their religion isn't based on any reason. It's not based upon objective evidence. It's based upon how they feel. Now, we should have feelings. Now, the lesson this morning is not basically designed to deal with not having feelings. It's designed to base to talk about the kind of feelings that we are to have. When we talk about heartfelt religion, you understand, I'm sure most of you, that the Bible heart involves four different areas. First, it involves the intellect, which receives instructions or facts and understands those facts or those instructions. In Romans chapter 10 and verse 9, Paul said, if thou shalt believe in thy heart, or if thou shalt confess with thy mouth Jesus as Lord, and believe in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. For with the heart man believes unto righteousness, and with the mouth confession is made unto salvation. And so a person believes with his heart. And so when we talk about the heart, and people sometimes say, I wouldn't trade what I have here for anything in the Bible. I've had people tell me that. They're patting the wrong place. The heart isn't here. The heart's up here. The heart is the part that thinks. It's the intelligence. And furthermore, it is the will. Not only must we reason and think, we must decide. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 17, he said, thanks be to God that though you were servants of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of teaching to which you were delivered. Being then made free from sin, ye became the servants of righteousness. And so it is with the heart that a person obeys. A person may believe and not obey. He may believe with his heart and not act from his heart, and therefore he has not used his heart fully in conversion. And then there are emotions. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 7 and 9, the writer Paul talks about the emotion of joy. First, as he said, ye who are troubled, rest with us. And the word rest there is a noun. You receive rest with us. And that certainly is a promise that should cause us to be happy and rejoice. But then he says, when Jesus comes in flaming fire, rendering vengeance to those who do not know God and to those who have not obeyed the gospel, that should cause us fear. And so when we talk about emotion here, we're talking about joy or fear. And in the morning service, we're going to be talking about anger. And these things are emotion. And certainly we should have emotion in our religion. And then there's the conscience. In 1 John 3, verses 19 to 21, John talks about if our heart condemns us and if our heart does not condemn us. If our heart condemns us, that means that our conscience is pricking us. If our heart does not condemn us, that means our conscience is approving of us. Remember Saul of Tarsus, the Apostle Paul, who said in Acts chapter 23 and verse 1, brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God unto this day. What's he saying? He's saying, even when I was persecuting Christians, I was living with a good conscience. My conscience approved of what I was doing because I was doing the things that I believe were right. And so the conscience either approves or disapproves based upon what we have accepted is right. I use the illustration of a cruise control on a car. I've been to Romania. In fact, I was there just this past August. And this is my sixth trip over there. That doesn't make me any expert on foreign evangelism, but I've gone and stayed a month each time, except the first time when our daughter died while I was over there and had to come back after 10 days. But anyway, I've been six times, and one of the meetings I was preaching about the conscience, and I used the illustration of a cruise control. Well, the interpreter was having a time interpreting that. Most of those people did not even own a car. None of them knew what a cruise control was. And he was struggling, trying to figure out what I was talking about when I was talking about a cruise control. But now all of you know what I'm talking about. If you set your cruise control on 70 going down the interstate, it'll keep you on the 70. But if you change where you are and the speed limit has dropped to 55, that cruise control will not automatically adjust itself. You have to do it. And if you don't do it, you may be in trouble. Now, that's the way our conscience is. If you set your conscience right, it'll keep you right. It'll prick you when you go wrong. But if you don't set it right, it won't prick you. Just because it doesn't prick you doesn't mean that you're all right. It may mean that you didn't set it right. And so our conscience acts simply on the basis of what we have accepted as right or wrong. Now I want to notice some Old Testament illustrations people who had a problem with their emotion or with their feeling. Look first at Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3. Eve was deceived. Someone said she followed false revelation. Well, of course, she knew better. She knew that she was not to do that. But you know, Adam, it doesn't even indicate that he was deceived. He just did it. Why did he do it? Somebody said after his wife gave it to him, he was afraid to turn it down. I don't really think that's it. But anyway, why did he do that? I think he did that because of his emotion. And you think about it. If you could have been there, of course you couldn't have been, but just for the sake of illustration, if you could have been there and taught Adam and Eve so that they would not have sinned when they were tempted by the devil, what would you have told them that they did not know? Did they not know that they were not to eat that fruit? What would you have given them that they did not have? They had everything in the garden except one tree. What would you have given them that they didn't have to keep them from doing what they did? You know, our government feels like that the way to get rid of criminals is that we give them more and we teach them more. You know what we have? We have rich, educated crooks. Because they haven't been changed. In the case of Adam and Eve, they knew enough, they had enough, but they sinned. Why? Because of their want to. Their emotion. They wanted that forbidden fruit. Look at another illustration. This is one of my favorites, maybe yours too, of Balaam. In Numbers chapter 22, where Balak, the king of the Moabites, had seen what the Israelites were doing to others, and he decided that he wanted the Israelites cursed so that they would not be able to defeat the Moabites. And so he sent some of his servants to Balaam and asked Balaam to come and curse the Israelites. And in verse 12, God said to Balaam, "You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed." Do you think that Balaam understood that? I do. I'm not all that bright, but I'll tell you, I clearly understand that revelation. God said, "You cannot go with them. You cannot curse them." What did he want to do? He wanted to go with them, and he wanted to curse them. God said, "You can't go, and you can't curse them." Plain. Now look at verse 13. So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, "Go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to give me permission to go with you." Great decision, Balaam. Great decision. God won't let me go back without me. But then Balak sent more numerous and more honorable messengers, princes to him. And then Balaam says in verse 18, "Then Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, 'Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more.'" And oh, that the story had ended there, right? Oh, if it had just ended there. "If he'd give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more." But that's not the end of the story, is it? He said, "But stay here tonight that I may know what more the Lord will say to me. Maybe the Lord hasn't told me all that he's going to tell me. Maybe he'll tell me something else other than don't go and don't curse him." Well, what else is he going to tell him? Well, the Lord told him you can go. I don't know why the Lord permitted him to do that. I don't understand all about that. I do understand as a parent that sometimes we give permission to our kids to do things when it's not really our will. It's not what we want them to do, but we permit them to do it. And maybe God just let Balaam do that to illustrate this point, that sometimes people are so intent on doing what they want to do, the Lord lets us suffer the consequences of doing what we want to do instead of wanting to serve Him. So he allowed him to go, and he saddled his donkey and took two servants with him. And as he was traveling, going to curse the Israelites, an angel with a sword drawn, appeared in the way. And the donkey turned into the field. Balaam hit him, got him back on the road, going to curse God's people. They came to another place, and the donkey turned in, saw the angel again, and he turned into a wall and crushed Balaam's leg, and Balaam hit him again, get him in the road, we're going, I got a mission here. Third time, the angel appeared, and he was in a narrow place, and the donkey could turn to neither side, and so he fell down under Balaam. Balaam struck him again, and God opened the mouth of that dumb beast and said, "Why have you struck me these three times?" And you know, Balaam was so mad and upset, he talked back to his own donkey. I think that would have been me. That had been one donkey less a rider. But you look at what he said here. Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you have abused me or mocked me, I wish there were a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you." And the donkey talked to him again and said, "Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden ever since I became yours to this day? Was I ever disposed to do this to you?" And he said, "No." I mean, carrying on a conversation. Why in the world would a man do that? Well, now, fortunately, the Bible tells us. And if you turn to 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 15, you'll see why he did it. The New Testament tells us plainly why Balaam did that. 2 Peter 2 and verse 15, "They have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness." Why did he do it? Because he was in love with unrighteousness. Why do people do what they do today? Because they don't know better? Sometimes. But a lot of times it's simply that they love the wages, they love the fruit of unrighteousness. And so, that's the reason he was doing what he was doing. Let's notice another illustration of David. In 2 Samuel, in chapters 11 and 12, the well-known story of David seeing Bathsheba and lusting after her and sending to find out who she is, realizes that she is the wife of another man, sent for anyway, late with her. She sent the message to him then that she was with child. And then David begins to cover up his sin, or try to. He has her husband Uriah brought home under the guise that he wanted him to report on how the war was going. And so he came and asked him about it and then told him to go home and spend the night. Well, what's he doing? A devious way to try to cover his sin. Uriah wouldn't go home. The next day, David made him drunk, hoping in his drunken stupor he wouldn't have any better sense than to go home. And so Uriah still wouldn't go home. He slept on the king's doorstep. The next day, David wrote a letter and said, "Take this to Joab, the captain of the host," which told him to put Uriah in the front lines when the battle gets hot, then where the strong enemies are, then you all withdraw and let them kill him. Murder. Why? He has a heart problem. He has an emotional problem. Did he know he was wrong? Oh, yes. But he still wanted to justify and cover what he'd done. And then the Lord calls a prophet named Nathan. Said, "Nathan, I have a job for you. I want you to go preach to King David." Now let me think with you a minute. What is Nathan going to tell David that David doesn't already know? Is he going to go in and say, probably my approach would have been this. "David, I know you're the king, but I'm God's prophet. God told me to tell you you're wrong. And you aren't going to like it, but you sit there and listen to me till I get through talking to you." You know what he'd probably said? "Take this note to Joab." But you know, Nathan didn't do that, did he? Nathan knew that David knew that he was wrong. And so he made up a story. He said, "David, I have a problem. And I want your help in solving this problem. There was a rich man who had many flocks and herds. There was a poor man who was a neighbor of his that had one ewe lamb that he'd bought. He'd raised it as a pet, slept with that lamb." You know how people are about their pets. And so he said, this rich man had a guest to come, and rather than take one of his many flocks and herds to feed his guest, he went and took the poor man's pet and fed his guest with it. What's going to happen to the man? Oh, David could see the folly of that, the heartlessness of such an act. And he said, the man that did that shall be killed and restore fourfold for what he's done. And Nathan pointed that finger and said, you are the man. You're the one I'm talking about. Now, what is David going to say? He said, I've sinned. You know, I preach the gospel to people, and I hate to confess this on myself, but I'm sure maybe Paul has done this too. I don't know. He's may have more heart in his and emotion in his than I've had. But there's one place I preached, we had a young girl, teenager, who was dating this boy who's a member of the denomination, and she was talking to him about conversion and about the necessity of baptism, and I was giving her arguments. She could make the argument as well as I could because she could read the scriptures and show him what it said. And she was trying to convince him that baptism was necessary for the remission of sins, to wash away sins, to be saved. But there was a problem. She hadn't done it. Intellectually, she was making the arguments to him. But emotionally, it didn't mean anything to her. She hadn't obeyed. She went with him one night to a revival at his denomination. And the preacher preached on hell, fire, and brimstone and condemned her, convicted her and showed her that she was a hell-bound sinner. And he converted her. Now, I baptized her into Christ, but I'll tell you something. He converted her. I had taught her intellectually what she needed to do, but I had not reached her emotion, her want to. And brethren, we can know the truth, and we can teach the truth, and we can teach it to others, and they're not going to obey it unless they feel the need to do it. Did you do it before you felt a need to do it? I didn't. I can remember as a young man sitting on the front row, Harry Pickup Sr., and he's the only preacher we thought we could have. Had him 5 years in a row in a meeting at my home, and he asked the brethren to ask somebody else the next year. They asked somebody else next year. They had him back the next. He was a great preacher in my estimation. We had just the local men doing the preaching. And I won't tell you about some of that kind of experiences. But anyway, the only kind of preaching, real preaching we heard was during gospel meetings. And it just seems to me like all they preached on was hell, fire, and brimstone. I could just smell the smoke. And I remember when I went forward, it wasn't any matter. Now let me see. 2 + 2 = 4. Belief plus baptism equals salvation. I think I agree with that. That wasn't the way it was. I felt I was lost. And until a person feels that he's lost, he won't be driven to obey. Now let's know some examples in the New Testament. Demas. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 10, Paul said, Demas hath forsaken me, because he decided the Lord's Supper shouldn't be observed on the first day of the week. All right? Demas hath forsaken me because he decided that the local church shouldn't exist. All right? No, that's not right. Why did Demas forsake him? Demas forsook me having loved this present world. It's not an intellectual problem. It's an emotional problem. He's in love with the wrong thing. That's why Demas forsook him. In Matthew chapter 25, in the parable Jesus told of the talents, there was the 5-talent man, the 2-talent man, and the 1-talent man. And we'll not read the whole thing, but in verse 24, when the 1-talent man came to give his account, what did he say? He said, Lord, I knew. Now, that's far as we need to go for the point of this lesson. Lord, I knew. Did he know enough? He convicted himself. Did he have enough? Absolutely. He knew enough? He had enough. Would he have done better if he'd had 2 or 10? Not likely. It wasn't a problem of how many he had. Brother Conway Skinner, some of you may know him, but he was a great preacher in my estimation. But I heard him say that brethren come to him and say, "Brother Skinner, I'm just like the one talent man. I don't have much ability." He said, "Yes, brother, you are. You're not using what you got." That wasn't the response they expected. The one talent man was not condemned because he didn't have enough. He was condemned because he didn't use what he had. I knew, but I was afraid. What's that? Right here. Emotion. Afraid. Afraid to try. Look at another illustration, Agrippa. In Acts chapter 26, Paul had preached his heart out to this man. And then he said to him, "King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets?" And then Paul answered his own question and said, "I know that you believe." And then Agrippa said, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." And I'm going to make this statement, though I know it's not in the text. I believe it. That when the Apostle Paul made the statement in Acts chapter 26 and verse 29, "I would to God that not only you, but also all who hear me this day might become almost and altogether such as I am, except these chains." I believe Paul said that through tears. He has preached his heart out to this man. And he's quoted the promise. He's shown him that the Christ had died for him. And Agrippa said, "Almost you've got me." I studied with a young man that made that exact statement to me once. We were in Columbus, Georgia. This fellow was at Fort Benning. And I studied with him, I think, third or fourth lesson. He was a member of the denomination that believed you're saved by faith only, and once you've been saved, you couldn't be lost regardless of what you did. And he was a good student. He knew what he believed. And we'd studied, and every time he would bring up a subject, I'd show him what the Bible says. He'd say, "Frank, I think you're right. I think you're right. I believe that's what the Bible teaches." After about the third or the fourth lesson, he looked at me and he said, "Frank, I hate to make this statement, but," he said, "I'll have to say like Agrippa, you've almost got me." I walked in the house that night. My wife knows me like a book. I tell people, if I ever got any meanness, I'd walk in the door and she'd say, "Okay, what was her name?" And she just looked, sees right through me. She looked at me and she said, "Honey, was it that bad?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know whether I ought to rejoice or cry, but right now I feel more like crying." And I told her what he'd said. "You've almost got me." That's what Agrippa said. As far as I know, that's as close as that guy ever got to obeying the gospel. Almost, but lost. What's the problem? Not his intellect. He knew. But his want to. You know, the religion of Christ is a religion that's based on choices. And we make those choices not only with our intellect, but with our will, but with our emotion. And our emotion has to be involved really before we're going to act upon the will. The will is going to decide to act. And we need to understand that we should have emotion, or we should have feeling in our religion. I've had people say, "These people don't seem to have any emotion in their singing, any feeling in their singing." I'm glad that's not my impression this morning of you. I'm sure there were some of you who weren't singing. There usually are who ought to be. They don't have any heart, any feeling in their religion because they're not singing and making melody from the heart. Somebody says, "Well, I just sang in my heart." Not if you didn't sing, you didn't. You can't keep your mouth shut and sing. You teach and admonish one another. And teach and admonish one another, you got to say something. And yet we don't do it. We are to participate in worship. I don't know if any of you have been to Williamsburg, Virginia or not. But As I told you, I preached in Richmond about 5 years, and I went to Williamsburg so many times when preachers had come to preach meetings, I'd take them to Williamsburg. A whole lot rather take them there to Washington, than to Washington, D.C. Even back then, Washington was a busy place, and I didn't particularly enjoy going there, though I did go there several times. But I went to Williamsburg so many times, they gave me a guide pass, so I didn't have to pay to get in anything. And I've seen the movie The Patriot in the Information Center. If any of you ever been, or if you're going, be sure that you see the movie The Patriot in the Information Center. It gives you the background of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, especially of Virginia and their decision. And the main character, and it is a fictitious character, named John Fry. And to make a long story short, they're dealing with a period coming up to declaring independence from England. Patrick Henry, who made his famous "Give me liberty or give me death" speech, he made that in what's now Episcopal Church building in Richmond, Virginia. At the time, it was the Church of England. And I've been in that building. And it's interesting to see some of these places, but anyway, as they came down to the vote, John Fry said that he needed the advice of his son as to how he should vote. His son was a student in the College of William and Mary, so he sent for his son and said, "Son, up until now, I thought it my duty to counsel you. Now I think it's your duty to counsel me. It's your future we're voting on. If we vote for independence, we're voting for war and bloodshed. And if we vote independence, your inheritance could be a legacy of blood. And I need to know how you feel I should vote." And about the third time, the roll caller called out the name John Fry. John's son said, "Dad, we vote aye." John Fry said, "Aye." The roll caller said, "The motion is carried unanimously. We are free." And then he goes to the side with his son. And as always, glad the movie had a little bit of dark space after this, a little bit of space for me to dry my tears, because men aren't supposed to cry, you know. But John Fry went aside with his son and said, "Son, we made our choice. It was a hard choice, but it was a free choice. But if men want to be free, they have to learn to choose. And I tell you, you don't have to have much preacher blood in you to want to get up and start preaching there. If you want to be free, you have to learn to choose. And my brother or sister, if you want to stay free, you have to keep on choosing." And we use our intellect and we use our emotion in making those choices. The Word of God will produce emotion. It produced such emotion that it'll cause fear and trembling. It'll cause tears. We have to move people by teaching them the gospel of Christ, that they may be convicted of the truth and that they may be moved then to act in obedience to that truth. I don't know your condition. There may be those in our audience this morning who know the truth that have never felt the need to do anything. I hope that we can make you so miserable that you can't sleep till you do something. I really do. I hope that your conscience will just prick you so that you cannot sit there, stand there, that you have to do something to get your life right with God. Or if you have been baptized into Christ, but you have fallen away and you've turned away and you know that if you died as you are now, you'd be lost. I hope we can make you realize by the emotion of fear first that Jesus is coming in flaming fire, rendering vengeance. And love, because Jesus died for you. And He wants you to be saved. But you have to decide to do it. And He won't make you do it, but He'll give you reason to do it. If you need to respond to heaven's invitation this morning, while we stand together and while we sing, I invite you to come.